I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your first time ever hearing our show, I've got good news. It's based on a really simple idea that all of us have had a teacher in our life who inspired us and helped us become the people we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether it's a teacher, coach, professor, whoever, they're all nominated by the people who listen. So we want you to be a part of this show. Please tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who you think deserve a spotlight. Please email us with your nominations. Nominate them to be on the show at teacherslounge@niu.edu. And today on the show, it is Jennifer Burdett. She teaches social studies and civics at the Spoon River Valley School District in Western Illinois. And we had a really great conversation about what it means to do social studies. You know, like, you go to science class to do science. You go to math to do math. What does doing social studies look like? Well, for her, it's learning to take action in society and in your community. That's why she has a class called Taking Action, where students don't just learn about how local and state government works. They don't just research problems they think need to be solved. They try to solve them, whether it's fixing potholes or school lunches.
Students have a lot of opinions about what they want their foods to be. Well, the kitchen doesn't always appreciate my students taking on this project. And I'm like, oh, you're going to get me in trouble again, but let's go for it.
We also get into her recent trip to the Smithsonian, her work with the Democracy Schools program, and one of the best compliments she's ever gotten from a student: Mrs. Burdett, I question things because of you. But before my conversation with Jennifer, I've got a few more education stories we want to share. Earlier this year, the Trump administration tried to freeze $1 billion in federal funding for Illinois childcare, and courts have blocked it so far, and I got to learn more about the program that would be hit the hardest by a freeze if it's allowed to stand: Illinois' Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP.
It says twos and tots, and they're doing circle time if you want to go in there.
What about this?
It's a tiger.
It's a tiger.
What'd the tiger do?
It's circle time for toddlers at First Step Daycare in Belvedere. This is their morning learning time, often in both English and in Spanish. And that first voice you heard is First Step's program director, Victoria Martinez. And she says that 94% of their families rely on the child care assistance program. So if the funding freeze were to go through,
we'd shut down. 100% we'd have to shut down because we can't afford to pay the bills.
And it's not just them either. Other Illinois childcare facilities have said they'd have to close down too. They often run on very slim margins, so any disruption could put them at risk. In total, CCAP subsidizes childcare for around 100,000 low-income families in Illinois across thousands of childcare facilities. Kelsey Bakken is the director of policy at Advance Illinois, an education advocacy group. And she says that the administration didn't try to directly cut funding for CCAP, but it targeted three programs, two of which fund CCAP.
It totals around 60% of the revenues that we have to fund CCAP, so it is a significant portion.
The Trump administration claims that the freeze is because of widespread fraud, but Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin says they haven't shown any evidence.
The audits go on by the state and federal government all the time, looking over their shoulders to make sure they're following the law. There is no waste, fraud, and abuse.
Victoria Martinez at First Step says she was confused when she heard about the fraud allegations.
When I fill out my paperwork, there's so many, I want to say, checks and balances in place. It's like, what time does your child get to the daycare? What time do you work? And how far away is your work from the actual daycare?
And families have to fall under certain financial thresholds to qualify for CCAP. And a recent report from the Illinois Answers Project found that Illinois' eligibility limits are actually considerably higher than even federal recommendations. But for families who are approved, it can make a huge difference. Martinez says it's not that CCAP makes childcare free, it's a sliding scale based on income.
So with two working parents that work, you know, decent hours and a decent job, the highest I've seen is like $400 a month. But again, the lowest I've seen is like a single mom, minimum wage, $1 a month.
Benita Pedroza is a single mom with two kids who go to First Step. She moved to Illinois last year and doesn't have any family in the area, so she was worried she wouldn't be able to find childcare that she could trust and that she could also afford.
I know they were estimating me for the private prices like $500 a week. And I was like, well, realistically, I'm not going to make that much money, so it's just best for me to stay home if I have to pay this. But then when we did the CCAP, it went from $500 a week to just $200 a month. So I am literally saving thousands of dollars on childcare for my girls.
Her copay recently dropped to $80 a month, and if she didn't have CCAP, it would have been $2,000 a month.
I was so happy. I cried when they told me that we were accepted because, you know, it's just a good opportunity for the girls.
Pedroza was stressed when she heard about the potential freeze. She started looking for jobs she could do from home while also looking after her girls. It'd been so hard to find a place like First Step, and now she might have to start over and without the extra financial support.
I just knew that my girls were in a good place, especially when they don't cry at drop-off and they're happy to be there.
Earlier this month, a federal judge issued a preliminary injunction in the case, so funding has been flowing normally and First Step hasn't shut down. The injunction remains in place until the full case is decided. In total, the Trump administration tried to freeze $10 billion in childcare funding in California, Colorado, Minnesota, New York, and the $1 billion in Illinois.
And the cow. What's a cow say?
Do Illinois high schoolers have what it takes to solve real-world problems? A group of students had months to research food system issues and find a solution as part of Northern Illinois University's first-ever innovation challenge, and I got to be there. We are 1 hour from the presentations. 6 months of work comes down to a five-minute presentation, but DeKalb senior Margaret Ninia says they're not nervous, at least not yet.
Excited now. I'll be nervous later, but I'm excited.
DeKalb is one of five teams taking on the challenge. And near the beginning of the school year, Nenia says they were presented with two big, broad problems related to the food system and told, pick one and go.
Which was, I'm very thankful for because it left room for a lot of creativity in our solution.
The two options? Antibiotic resistance in cattle and microplastics in seafood. Senior Mohammed Al-Fateed said their group landed on microplastics, and even though the cattle question seems a little more relevant to rural Northern Illinois, they found a way to connect their solution to their community.
We specifically are focused on agriculture because the seed coatings in the seed has a coating and that has microplastics in it, which I didn't even know until we were introduced to this problem, and then most of us didn't know it either.
Coatings are used to improve germination and make seeds less fragile. The DeKalb students' idea is to make these coatings out of shellfish and fungi instead of plastic. And a group from Romeoville High School attacked the same microplastic problem, but from a very different angle. And seniors Dylan Preston and Joey Chaboy say it took them months to find it. Professionals spend years researching this, and sometimes it leads you down a rabbit hole to nowhere.
Where's the start? Oh my goodness. Joey and I would work like long nights at Starbucks. We kept seeing all these things that didn't lead to a solution. Like, oh, this would lead to more problems. And it was depressing for a time.
But then, after dead end, Dylan and Joey had a breakthrough.
My hand still hurts from that high five we did. But
instead of cleaning up microplastics, go right to the source.
We learned about this thing called photocatalysis.
It'll break down harmful substances, including microplastics, which is what makes us believe we can make a self-dissolving plastic.
And over the months, NIU appointed mentors helped them turn that idea into a product. And up to the last minute, students and staff helped them make final tweaks. But now, it's time to present Shark Tank style to a panel of judges. And the Romeoville group is up first. And their presentation is a sales pitch.
We incorporate that into the manufacturing process of polyethylene, which is our type of plastic we're working with, then we can hopefully create a self-dissolving piece of plastic.
Judges ask them, how long would it take to dissolve? They say 6 months to a year in the sun. Well, what about any harmful byproducts from that? They've thought of that too. Every presentation's different. Some bring props, handmade models, or made YouTube videos.
Our roll-and-go solution? Cleaner stables mean healthier livestock.
And now it's DeKalb's turn, and the group steps up to the front and takes turns setting water bottles full of colorful beads on a table.
Now take 10 of those bottles, and what we have now is a representation of all of the microplastics found in our oceans.
Al-Fateed and the team say one big culprit, those plastic seed coatings.
And so we are here today to propose an alternative to seed coatings made from a material known as chitosan. A biodegradable, all-natural alternative.
After they wrap up, he's feeling confident.
I feel like it went better than I thought it would, I'm going to be completely honest.
Now it's time for the awards. The top three get a cash prize, and the winner also gets a scholarship to one of NIU STEAM's summer camps. another group from Romeoville wins. And even though the months-long innovation challenge is over, they're not ready to stop working. Many students like Joey Chaboy think their solutions have the potential to make real change.
And we had one of the judges actually come up to us and say that we could get in contact. He loved our idea, and he said we could get in contact with some scientists, some grad students at NIU. It could be possible to make this into a tangible idea, which I think is amazing.
And the organizers at NIU say that was the whole point, to help high school students attack these problems, not as practice or for a grade, but to make a real impact. All right, now it is time for my conversation with Spoon River Valley Social Studies and Civics teacher Jennifer Burdett. And we start off talking about all of the different classes and grade levels that she gets to teach.
I teach junior high rotational. So first semester, I have seventh grade. Second semester, I have eighth grade. I teach study skills, which I guess kind of falls into the social studies realm, but it's more so a need that we fulfill. And then my favorite junior high rotational class is my eighth grade one. I teach a taking action course is what I designed and called it. And so it really fulfills a lot of the civics requirements. But that lets me dabble in the junior high world a little bit. And then I spend the rest of my day in the high school world teaching American history, civics, current events, geography.
I mean, you've got a little bit of everything then in terms of like you're teaching pretty much every social studies adjacent classes that you could be.
I mean, there's definitely a few other ones out there that haven't been thrown at me yet, but I like the variety to my schedule and the fact that I don't do the same thing at any point in my day. So it keeps things fresh and new.
Yeah, I was going to say you get variety in terms of the type of classes you're teaching and also the grade level.
Yeah.
Taking action is a really fun name for a class. What are they taking action on these days?
So the course is divided kind of into three parts. So we start with a look at kind of the citizens' role in the government and how citizens in the past have played a role. We look at different movements that have helped shape. We look at the idea of citizens, and we look at kind of that idea of what are the core foundational things we need for our government to survive the way in which it was structured, and a lot of that being really dependent on citizen involvement. And then from there, we kind of shift to where they start to explore an issue that they care about. So the students design a speech around an issue that they're passionate about. And then the third step is where they either get to decide to stick with the project that they initially proposed with their speech, or they can collaborate with someone else's idea to actually try and affect change on that particular issue. So the issues that the students come up with have been all across the board. We've had issues that are very school related, you know, everything from we want different PE shorts to different cafeteria foods. And then we've had people who have wanted to take issue on their towns, things related to the healthcare field, and then things more at the state level. And so what the final step in that project where the taking action comes into play is they actually have to reach out to a stakeholder who has influence over it. So they present to administrators if it's school-related issue. We've sent letters out to the communities. Last year, we had a really cool experience where students wanted the healthcare industry to offer rides to rural regions. And so we actually got to meet with an official at Graham Hospital and have a conversation with them about the student project. So it's very much about the students going and actually trying to bring their research and their findings to stakeholders who can actually hopefully affect things. The one, we went to the town council and they presented, and ultimately the town kind of agreed that yes, they would like to change something at the park. So making it as authentic as possible for student learning.
Yeah, I was going to say, have we had, whether it be basketball shorts or state legislation, like, have we had some wins?
We've had a few small wins, yes. But I think the most meaningful part of this is sometimes when they have the conversations, they realize the complexity of the problem that, you know, from their research or their viewpoint, it seems really cut and dry of we should just do this. Like, we can just implement it and it's that effective and immediate. And sometimes it is that simple, but other times it's, well, what about the costs or what about federal regulations or things like that, where they realize, okay, maybe it's not as simple. And so it allows them to have a better understanding of how government works and maybe some of the different ways you have to go about approaching these problems.
Yeah. And these are middle schoolers too, right?
Yeah. These are eighth graders who are doing it. So, I mean, it's not something that's out of their realm of capabilities, right? They're totally able to be involved citizens and do stuff now, even though they aren't full citizens yet, right? They haven't.
Right. They can't vote.
Yeah. But they still have a way to make change.
Are there trends of like particular topics that come up over the past couple of years and maybe multiple students in a class kind of want to explore similar types of issues, or is there tend to be just a lot of variety?
The biggest issue that has traditionally gotten me in some contentious waters is the kitchen and the fact that students have a lot of opinions about what they want their foods to be.
Of course.
The kitchen doesn't always appreciate my students taking on this project and the fact of, you know, it isn't as simple as just we're going to change the food to whatever the kids want because of federal regulations and things like that. But I still allow them to go through with it. And it has calmed down a little bit in recent years in terms of the kitchen. But that was a really hot topic that every year they're like, we want to do this one. And I'm like, oh, you're going to get me in trouble again, but let's go for it. So,
well, if it's cooled down in the last couple of years, maybe that just means the food's great, you know?
That could be, yes. But yes, that's probably the most contentious one that they always want to seem to go through. But this year, we're in the midst of this right now, and they're writing their speech, and there's a lot more focus on drugs and some of that impact. And so I thought that was kind of an interesting shift in terms of what the students are bringing. But, you know, I try to make it very much based on their lived experience. A couple of years ago, it was the roads. They were very passionate about the potholes and the roads, and we were trying to reach out. And the other really interesting part of it is that they have to go and collect data from the community. So they create polls that we send out. If it's a community issue, we try to get it out on social media so that as many community members as possible can participate. Obviously, if it's a school community, it's much easier to pull the students and things about the issues. But it is a very involved process where they're trying to get as many opinions from different stakeholders as they possibly can.
I love it. Potholes is as local government as it gets, you know? It's interesting that you have such a variety, again, like such a range of students in your class. I feel like that's not super, super common when it comes to, like, you know, especially at the K-12 level, where, you know, on a given day, you're having students from seventh grade all the way through presumably like seniors in high school. It's like students at very different stages of development, you know, within the same topics. It's got to be really fascinating to see over the course of your day.
Yeah. And I think one of the really fun parts, I don't know, the part I cherish the most about the experience is the fact that I get to see how they grow from, you know, a seventh grader to senior and watch kind of their evolution of thinking. So it's fun, especially when they're junior high, right? Like they have all these really strong opinions. And when you try to ask them why, like, tell me your why of why you believe it, they struggle a lot of times with really coming up with the why, because I feel like they are heavily influenced by the things that they're exposed to around them and the voices they hear around them. But by the time they're senior, I really have seen that they can now articulate what their thoughts are and what their viewpoint is because of different experiences they've been through or different lessons that they've learned in life from, you know, either school or the outside community and such. So it's fun to see them grow in their citizenship in that way.
Yeah, I feel like you need to follow up with them when they're like 28, see how much more things have changed since then, you know?
Well, being a small community, I do get to.
That's true. That's true.
It is a highlight when you get to hear from past students.
Yeah, that's really cool, though. You know, one thing I wanted to ask, too, and this could be in your Making Change class, this could be in geography, this could be in any of them. I always like to ask people, because like my mom was a classroom teacher, my stepmom is a classroom teacher. One of my favorite things about that is that you get to come home at the end of the day and hear stories about everything that happened that day. And I'm just curious, like somewhat, you know, recently, do you have a moment from your classroom where like, things just went really well and you're like, yeah, this is exactly what I'm trying to do?
So the most recent one I would say was last week. I'm part of the Smithsonian Digby Exchange. And so what that does is it, as part of the 250th anniversary, they're bringing teachers from around the country together, and then their classrooms participate in a virtual exchange. And so this semester, I'm paired with a teacher in New York. Last semester, I was paired with a teacher in Maine. But we've just started this exchange process. And so they got their postcards from their exchange buddy in the other classroom. And then last week they got to have their first virtual exchange. And so, you know, putting 18 students on different Zoom calls is an interesting experience. So they were kind of scattered throughout the school here and lining kind of the hallway is where many of them decided to congregate, but administration and different people were walking through and just seeing the smiles on their faces and the chatter as they were talking. And then as conversations are being told that they have to wrap up, students going, but I don't have enough time. Like, I want to keep talking to them. I think those are the most meaningful parts of the social studies universe, is the fact that it's very much about connecting with people and trying to understand different perspectives. And so when you can see students engaging in that process, it's very meaningful work.
Oh, that's cool. So like when you have a partner school district in Maine or wherever else, like how are they interacting throughout the semester then?
So there is a series of asynchronous and synchronous exchanges that take place. So like our first asynchronous one was the postcard exchange. So we mailed to each other those different things. There's going to be collaboration on different assignments that they'll do, reflection pieces. One of the reflection pieces from the first exchange was, if you could choose six symbols for your generation to represent you, what are the symbols? And so both classes have been working on coming up with symbols. They've also are in the process of creating a road trip where they have to show off their community and the places that are meaningful to them within their community. So my co-partner and I for this exchange are really focused on the idea of symbols and how can we represent ourselves as symbols and our communities as symbols and kind of our history as different symbols. So
do you know what they're coming up with for these symbols to represent their generation? I'm fascinated as someone who is completely out of touch at this point.
So I've only had a chance to look at the one so far, because it came from our exchange student. And so she put the cell phone, which like spot on, I feel like they we all are, but they thrive on those cell phones. And then she also listed vocabulary and then put things like, you know, broad, you know, just some of the slang and the way.
I knew it.
Hey, yes, like that's, you definitely have your key words. That 6-7, right? That I haven't gotten to go through the rest of them yet, but it's exciting to kind of have them reflect on these ideas and what it means to be living in this time and how would you represent who you are to other groups of people who might not understand your generation.
Yeah, that's it. I figured that we were going to go down at some point. There was going to be a 6-7 reference somewhere in there.
Avoid it, can you?
No, I hope maybe it's dying down now. I don't know. You could be our live correspondent for that one.
Depends on the class. Some are definitely attached to it.
Fair enough. And you got to go to the Smithsonian in Washington too, right?
Yeah. So as part of the exchange, they bring teachers into DC and allow us to work with different educators at the different Smithsonian museums. Phenomenal process. Application for cohort 6 just opened up. So I don't know if I can do a little plug or anything like
that. Plug away.
It is definitely one of the most meaningful experiences I've had and just such an important thing for students to have the exposure of, and especially being in such a small rural community, the fact that we're paired now with a classroom that's a 20-minute train ride to New York City and stuff, I think it just allows them to have better perspectives of what other parts of the country might look like. And you know, one of those hot topics was what do you do on a Friday night? And some of them were like, I hang out at a Walmart parking lot. And like, I've never been to a Walmart, and that kind of floored some of my students too. Like, what do you mean you've never been to a Walmart? So just small differences like that really highlight the human experience.
That's right. Listen, that's small town Midwest for you. If you got a Walmart, if you got a McDonald's, there's always a place to be.
We have none of those in our five communities.
That's rough. That's a tough one. That's when you're hoping that there's a communal barn that we can all hang out at or something. So with the, I mean, you mentioned about how like getting to go to the Smithsonian was really meaningful. Like what were some of the best parts for you?
So I really appreciated the most recent one. They brought in a presenter, educator from the Cooper Hewitt Design Museum in New York. And she took us through a design thinking process that very much paralleled what I do with that Taking Action course. So some of the materials, she had a little coffee shop activity for thinking through how to problem solve. That I think is going to be an important step in this Taking Action process of helping students think about how do I approach solving this problem. And as they're writing their speeches, I've noticed that problem solving is something that they're struggling a little with. So it's a good addition to something I was already doing. But I mean, just overall, the presenters that they bring in, the way in which they try to get us thinking about objects and places and how we can use those to meaningfully connect students to history. It's just phenomenal.
You know, one of the things that we always ask about Jen is that we always want to turn the clock back and do a little bit of a teacher origin story about how you became a teacher in the first place. I'm curious, you grew up here in Northern Illinois, kind of by me too, right? So like, you grew up around like the DeKalbish area, right?
Correct. Yep. I grew up in Hampshire. I don't know that there is like a profound moment that I decided I wanted to be a teacher. My aunt, who I was close with, was very much involved in the teaching world. She was an educator herself. And so I think maybe I saw her influence some, and I feel like it was one of those where I was lucky and I kind of just felt like I always knew what I was supposed to do, and that was teaching.
You always felt that way.
Yeah, I don't really remember, or at least from, you know, the point of where you really talk about your career, I don't remember ever really wanting to be anything else. I played school all the time.
You were one of those, huh?
Yeah. I also feel like teaching was always kind of my destiny.
Were you teaching your stuffed animals, or were you a teaching your siblings person, or both? Like, what did that look like for you?
I feel like it was more so teaching like my friends, like we would play together.
Yeah.
And the one that I'm thinking of, she also became a teacher. So, you know, very much similar paths in that regard. You know, I might have played with my stuffed animals too. Who knows?
So like when you were growing up, everything, like were you someone that really liked school then too?
Yeah. I always have enjoyed school and felt like school was kind of a safe place for me, a comfortable place to be. So.
And you said your aunt was a teacher. Like, what did she teach?
She was a religious education teacher. So she taught at a private school and was very much involved in that sphere.
Okay. So you kind of always knew that you wanted to be a teacher. Like, what about social studies specifically?
So I had a sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Jones, who I think kind of helped push me in the direction of social studies. I feel like she was pretty instrumental in that. But then I believe it was seventh grade, we went to Colonial Williamsburg with my parents. And I feel like that was kind of that moment where I just fell in love with history. Seeing it come to life there really just locked me in, and it made me fall in love with any other, like it had to be social studies from that point on. And then in high school, I had a history teacher, Mr. Collins, who was very instrumental in kind of making me further feel like social studies was the area I wanted to explore.
Wow. Do you remember much about that Colonial Williamsburg trip?
I remember feeling it was magical. Ironically, when I went on that Teaching American History trip, we went at Christmas time. So it was kind of that magical feel with, you know, the candlelight everywhere and the decorations and things seen.
Oh, yeah.
Christmas. But we went back as the Teaching American History trip, and we went to like the Governor's Mansion and some of that. And I'm like, oh, like this is very familiar. Like I can picture it in my head, and it still looks pretty much the same way I remembered it from being there in seventh grade. But I just, the way in which history felt very relevant, even though they were talking about, you know, far in the past, it just stuck with me.
So was there, I always think it's kind of fun where there's like a moment that you have like that, right? Where you're like, okay, this is what I want to do. This is the career I want to pursue. And then there's the second moment, which is that you pursue that path and you actually get the opportunity to try it, where it's not just hypothetical. You're actually in a classroom in front of students. And then there's the moment where you're like, okay, do I like the idea of doing this, or do I actually like doing this? I'm curious for you, do you remember some of your first moments actually like in front of a classroom?
Yeah. I had some fabulous kind of supporting teachers at my time at Monmouth College doing kind of that observation and things like that. But I student taught with Mr. Brown, the school district over, the school district I live in now. So I didn't go very far after the fact.
yeah.
But, you know, I just really enjoyed getting up there, and he was very much about trying to make it an experience and trying to get students to really relate to history. And so I think he helped shape a lot of that too. But, you know, when I started this whole process, I was very much like, I am going to be a junior high teacher. And that's what I student taught, was junior high. And I just, you know, felt like junior high was where I was meant to be. It was the area I loved. I thought that, you know, those students were still much more excited about school than maybe sometimes you're.
Sure. Yeah.
But then ironically, you know, things don't always go as planned. And at the time when I was applying for jobs, it was an extremely competitive teaching market. And so I got hired at a high school position for my first teaching experience. And I ended up moving away from the junior high and deciding I really kind of love my junior seniors. No discredit to any of my other age groups. I'm not dissing on any of them. I like them too, but I really like the thought process of the junior senior. So it's interesting to see how much I've moved away from I'm junior high and that's what I'm always going to be, to now I'm like, give me those junior seniors, please.
But now you still get the best of both worlds a little bit, though. You still do get the middle school.
I get to dabble in a little bit of everything, at least at this level. Please don't ever put me in an elementary classroom. I'm not meant to teach elementary.
That's what I want to see. I want to see the Making Change civics class in first grade. That's actually fascinating.
I mean, I can hook you up with some videos. I can get you in. I mean, very helpful for real with the teachers that do that, but I'm not that person.
And so how long have you been a professional in the classroom now? How many years is it for you?
I think I'm on year 17. I don't know. Something like
year 17.
That.
Well, I only ask because I'm always curious about, like, teaching social studies for almost two decades now, if you feel like the way that you think about social studies, if it's changed much over the years. I mean, I even think about with your Making Change class, right? I feel like civics is gets a big focus now, maybe more than it did 20 years ago. But I'm curious, again, for you, just what you think of when it comes to social studies and how you teach it, how you think about it, if you feel like it's changed much, or if you feel like it's been kind of solid the whole time?
I feel like who I am as a teacher at this point is completely different than who I was as a teacher when I started. And
how so?
I feel like my history experience was much more that traditional knowledge base of, you know, learning who the people, the places, and the events and things were. And so it was, you know, much more notes heavy, and more memorization, you know, what you think of as maybe your more traditional social studies.
And like works for some people, right? Like worked for you, right. And you know, kind of worked for me too, you know?
Yes. And, you know, like I thrived on that, but I get that, you know, when you ask most students what subject area they don't like, social studies tends to be one that pops into their minds because of things like that. But through my involvement with the civics rollout across the state and serving as a civics mentor, you know, I just was introduced to so many different techniques and ways of approaching it. And one of the things that, you know, I'll always go back to that Mary Ellen said in those sessions is, you know, students go to science class and they do science. They go to math class and they do math. And you go to social studies and you memorize names and dates. And it's like, where's the doing social studies? And so, you know, when I think back to my early rounds of students that I had before those experiences, I feel like I did them a disservice in the fact that they didn't get the version of me that I am now. But I do think that the different professional development and experiences that I've had the opportunity to be a part of have really changed me into more of that do teacher rather than just that memorized teacher.
Yeah, I do think it's a very positive sign, though, that you think that you're much better now than you were when you started. If you're like, actually, I nailed it 17 years ago and I haven't had to change at all, I think that might be a little bit of a red flag, you know? But yeah, it is fascinating, though, because social studies is something that, like, we do kind of need to define for students, right? Like, what is, if you really break down, like, what are we even talking about when we talk about social studies? I think that for a lot of us growing up, like you said, like, social studies was just synonymous with history. And so, like, what do we even mean by that? And I think now we mean it a bit more active and a bit more like, you know, civic engagement.
Yes, I would agree 100%. You know, moving from that just memorization to really that critical thinking and the discussion-based practices within my classroom and, you know, really having them reflect on what they're hearing, presenting different viewpoints on historical issues and having them, you know, decide where do you fall. And that's what I really try to stress to my students is my job isn't to tell you what to think as a social studies teacher. It's my job to teach you how to think, because I want you to go out and I want you to question the world that you live in. And I want you to wonder why things are and then see if you agree or disagree or where you fall in this. And so I try really, really hard. And I think one of the best compliments I've ever gotten from a student, and it was probably about the time of his senior year, was basically saying, like, Mrs. Burdett, I question things because of you. Like, you've taught us to question the things around us. And that's my goal. If I achieve that out of my students, if they leave here feeling like they have a sense of who they are and what they think they value and believe, and then they also know how to critically think about the world around them, then I feel like I've prepared them for civic life, and that at least to some extent, I'm accomplishing the goal of social studies education.
Yeah, you taught me how to question things. That's like a Yelp review that you should like print out and hang up in the classroom, you know? That's great. Yeah, you mentioned Mary Ellen Daniels, and I know that, you know, she is obviously a huge part of the Democracy Schools Network that you guys have been a part of for quite some time now, right?
So we joined in 2022. So we're on what, our third, fourth year going in here.
So for people who don't know what Democracy Schools is, can you give people an idea of what it is and what it looks like at your schools?
Sure. So the Illinois Democracy School Network is a network of schools across the state of Illinois, although the model is now being applied in some other states. So that's exciting news. But it kind of focuses on the idea of civics education isn't just something that we approach in the social studies classroom, but it's meant to be a district-wide initiative that all people within a school model for students what it means to be part of society. And by interacting with one another, we're modeling civic life and really trying to think about how those values should shape your school climate, culture, and then, you know, how you do your curriculum as well.
Yeah. Can you give a just quick example of kind of what that can look like outside of a social studies classroom?
So one thing that I was fortunate enough to pilot for the Democracy School program was the idea of participatory budgeting, which is where we created a student committee who had $2,000 to spend. We actually did it twice. We got to do it for the high school and the junior high. And so students had to go around and kind of think about what the needs for the school were and what they wanted to create to help improve the school environment. And then they researched it. They had to present it to admin to get approval of, yes, we could move forward with this as a proposal. And then the student body had to vote on that particular item. And ultimately, out of that pilot program, we ended up adding a coffee shop to our school for the high school that now our business class actually runs. So now we have a business class actually running a business and learning real life application skills. So that's pretty amazing. And the students enjoy having the opportunity to get coffee midday. And then the junior high really wanted to focus on trying to build some of that school culture. And so they bought some things to really express our identity. And when I say identity, it's a very complex world in our universe because we are Spoon River Valley, who are the Vikings. We are also, for some sports, the North Fulton Cooperative. So that's the Wildcats. And then for other sports, we are the LVC Co-op, which are the Miners. So we have three separate mascots that we use for different occasions. So when you try to get these kids to lock in on this is who I am as a school, this is our identity, that's very complex. But the exciting part is that our school board decided to make this a meaningful thing that students can repeat. So we are starting the process again now where students have been given a budget of money and they have to go through and repeat the process of how are you going to spend that money. So giving students control and voice within their school culture to actually influence the place that they spend the majority of their day.
That's really fascinating. Yeah, like again, like we talked about, everyone's got opinions about the food in their school. Everyone's got opinions about the facilities themselves. But to give people a voice, not just to have those concerns and not just have those, you know, critiques or comments, but to try to come to some sort of tangible solution is just a really fun opportunity. Do you have a go-to coffee order from the coffee shop at school?
I actually don't drink coffee, so it's really
me neither. I just assume other people do.
At the coffee shop, like we were learning how to make drinks and stuff. And it was definitely an eye-opening experience for me because I was learning about espresso and like we have some, I mean, they're not coffee shop quality like equipment, but it's still interesting to get to learn. And I mean, the kids are getting real life skills too. And I learned a little bit more about coffee myself.
Yeah. And, you know, with democracy schools too, and with civics, you've been helping out with kind of teaching more media literacy skills too, right? Like this idea of helping students be able to identify misinformation and disinformation, how to tell what's a good source and what's not. I'm really like fascinated about that topic because it's been going on in Illinois. We've had like different requirements for it for the past couple of years, but like there's no easy measure or like test or anything to know like if it's working or not. It's kind of a broad thing. And so I'm curious both about like what it looks like for you teaching some media literacy skills, but also like, do you feel like it's working?
Well, my favorite phrase is when a student comes to me, it's like, I saw on TikTok, and it's like, all right. And then we're going to break it down a whole bunch because it, depending on how that next part of that sentence goes, there's a lot that we can jump into. But I feel like the idea of media literacy, you know, I explicitly teach it in some form in basically all of my classes. But as far as if it's working or not, I can't promise what my students are doing on social media, right? I don't follow social media. So who knows? I could go to their comment sections and maybe they aren't using what I'm trying to teach them. But I feel like that critical thinking comes out in discussions and they do try to think about who the source is or what, you know, they're really good about throwing that word bias out and recognizing that. And more so to me, that idea of being able to weigh two different perspectives and listen and then form an opinion, I see those skills coming out in my students. I'm not saying they're perfect, but I see that they're there and that they're thinking about those things. So from my perspective, at least some of it's sticking and working
sure.
out. I'm all going to be doing some type of AI video, something around 100%.
Oh, that's fun, right? Right as you start to get a handle on things, then you get that curveball thrown in too.
Yes. Yeah.
gosh, I can't even imagine. Yeah. Well, it reminds me too about the conversation, like you said, about like identifying bias and having conversations with people about, you know, maybe contentious issue that, you know, like in a lot of civics classrooms and social studies classrooms, like teachers talk about the importance of, you know, like discussing current and controversial topics and giving students the tools to have those conversations in a more healthy way than what you see on social media most times. And again, like, I'm sure this can vary a lot, and you obviously can't speak to what it actually looks like when students are on social media, but like, I'm curious just for you in the classroom, if you feel like doing that sort of work does feel like it helps students have maybe more thoughtful and I would say hopefully like empathetic conversations, because again, sometimes it feels like with all these topics, once you get on social media, you kind of like revert to the rules of the platform, and the platform is for, like, you know, again, people to have arguments and things like that. But like, for teaching some of these skills of how to talk about current and controversial topics, if you feel them learning how to have more hopefully thoughtful and empathetic conversations with each other.
Definitely one of the best preps, and especially teaching in the social studies political environment that we teach in right now, having taken the Guardians of Democracy Current and Controversial Issues course has just given me so many tool sets to use to feel comfortable leading those types of discussions in my classroom, and to approach those types of topics from an angle where, yes, it's a controversial topic, but how can we do this in a meaningful way that's going to actually result in a productive conversation, right? Like, the comment sections on social media are most typically in no way, shape, or form what we want to model as civic dialogue between members of different viewpoints.
Right. And like I said, like, I think that sometimes we get out of those platforms and we revert to the rules of them and the kinds of things that those platforms reward for engagement. And that ends up becoming just like really toxic.
Yeah. And so I think that's why using our classrooms as a platform and as, you know, a laboratory, really, where students can engage in this kind of conversation with, you know, I guess me as mediator, but I will say that I feel like the students have gotten to a point where they do a pretty good job of mediating themselves and recognizing if someone ever does step outside those boundaries of what expectations are in that type of environment. So that's another win there too, right? When you can have students who are willing to patrol and say, no, like, you gotta bring it back in, like, that violates some of the norms of our conversation and such. But then discussion just in general is so important. And Teach Difference is another organization I work with that's really trying to bring those discussions in using a quote-based theory, and having students break down claim and counterclaim, and then reflecting on lived experience and then trying to kind of grapple with these opposing viewpoints and what that might look like and mean in the world today. So I just feel like discussion is one of my favorite things to do in the classroom and definitely an essential skill for students to practice in the society that we live in today.
Have you had some times recently where the conversation about some of these current and controversial issues did go really well and was really productive in the way that you wanted it to be?
Yeah. After Charlie Kirk's assassination, you know, we used one of the Teach Different quote methods to really look at that idea of, you know, the quote that I used was, "I disapprove of what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it," and allowing students to kind of grapple with that and the meaning of, you know, what are our values as a country? What does it mean to have freedom of speech? What should you consider when someone has different viewpoints of you, and yet how far should they be allowed to speak? And, you know, what happens when we silence people who disagree with us? And so that was kind of the lead in. And then we use a Tangle article so that we could look at kind of both perspectives relating to that. And the students just did a phenomenal job of really relating it back to kind of core American values and trying to think about what does it look like for a society. And I think that was the question that I posed to them as a reflection at the end too, is basically like, okay, you're the next generation and you're going to have power here soon. So like, what does this mean for you moving forward? What are your desires for a society and what you know, the future of our ability to converse with people of different opinions should be. And so they handled it very maturely and just had very thoughtful reflections on these different topics.
Earlier on in the conversation, you already have shouted out and mentioned a few of the educators you've had over the years of your life who've really inspired you. I was curious if there were any teachers that you wanted to mention right now who've had a big impact on you, and teachers that you maybe think about now when, you know, again, you're trying to improve and be the best teacher you can be. Again, they could be teachers that you had when you were a kid, they could be teachers that you work with now, but just anyone who you feel like has been really inspiring you lately.
Well, so I have to give a shout out to Mrs. Nielsen because she was my Spanish teacher and I loved her. And
yes.
Mrs. Niles because she was my coach and she, you know, pushed us hard, but she also made me grow a lot. I have to thank the whole civics mentor group, which, I mean, there's so many of them that have shaped who I am that I would hate to just name one because I don't want to leave any of the other ones out. So all of my civic mentor buddies that, you know, we still get so excited when we cross paths with each other and such. Very thankful for, obviously, Mary Ellen Daniels has been a huge part of shaping who I am as a teacher. And then I'll just say that I love my coworkers that I work with, and I feel very supported by the team that I have here. But again, I don't want to name just one because I'm thankful for them all. So how about we just do a shout out that way?
For my job, I get to go to a bunch of different schools, and like they're all super unique, and some of them have like really cool like murals that they're known for, or like artwork on the wall that is like something that's been there for a long time that the school really cares about. I was just curious if there's like, if you could say, what's your favorite little thing about your school? It could be anything, but I'm just curious what you have an answer for that.
I love walking into this building and the fact that like it just feels like home. Like it's just that little family community sense of like, I just feel very supported that no matter what, people are going to be there for me. And so I feel, I guess it's a sense of community. The community is what stands out to me about the school that I'm in, because I feel like we do a good job of creating that community feel for one another.
You know, we've talked a lot about the different challenges and things that come with it, but is there just something about teaching in general that you just wish more people talked about? Something that you just think is more important than people might realize about what your day-to-day is like?
There's a lot of topics that we could go into about that. But I think the idea that schools have very much become not a replacement for parents, but definitely to some extent, it feels like we're co-parenting with the parents, right? And the fact that with different mandates and things like that, there's been a lot of expectation put on schools to not just teach what is our curriculum, but to teach social interaction and you know, just some of those core things that I feel like used to be maybe more home directed. So when you're talking about teachers and what our responsibilities are, you know, it's not as simple as just saying, well, I stand in front of the classroom and I teach a lesson and I grade some papers and I go home at night. You know, we're serving as student listening ears. We're helping them give advice of what to do next in their lives. We're managing relationships for the students and trying to get them to coexist with one another. So there's a lot of pieces that a teacher's doing in any given day. It's not just the cut and dry of what someone might think a teacher has to do.
Oh yeah. I hear it all the time from teachers who are like, yes, I have to teach a subject, but I also have to be a counselor. I also have to be a parent in some ways. I also have to interact with parents and grade papers and do these, you know, 500 other things that like the actual teaching part of it is kind of the fun part of it sometimes, you know?
Yes. If I can just, you know, be at the front of the classroom and lead students through discussions and things like that, and if you can make my grading disappear, I'd be a much happier person, but I do appreciate, I guess, the fact that students are willing to look to us for some of those responsibilities.
All right. Well, Jennifer, the last question I have for you is along those same vein, but is just, what's something about social studies that you, again, just think is more important than people realize?
I think it's definitely that idea of critical thinking. I think it's about connection. And I think that, you know, so many people sometimes overlook the social studies, but I think, you know, when we ask ourselves the questions about why is the world the way that it is now, or, you know, why is this happening at this particular time, a lot of those.
How did we get here?
Have to go back to the social studies for, right? We have to understand how society has evolved or why different conflicts or events took place. But then we also have to be able to reflect on those and use those critical thinking skills to be able to decide what to do next. And, you know, if we can find the stories, if we can find the reflections of ourselves in those social studies, then it becomes much easier to relate and to see why the subject area is maybe so important. You know, and then you've got the whole civics side of it too, right? Of, you know, how do I go from just understanding the society to how can I be a participant and have voice in that society?
That was Jennifer Burdett, social studies and civics teacher at the Spoon River Valley School District. Thank you so much to everyone for listening to Teacher's Lounge. And as always, feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests like Jennifer. Please send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. Wherever you're hearing this podcast, subscribe, leave us a rating, share with a friend. It's the best way for us to get even more nominations and even more perspectives for the show. A big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode. And I've been your host, Peter Medlin. Thank you so much for joining us.